The Loose Cannons podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Hey everyone, another podcast coming at you, Loose Cannon style. I don't know what that means, but something.
Loose anus style.
No, gross. You're off the podcast.
This podcast took all of 10 seconds to get really weird.
All right, you're in 20 minute timeout, Hendrick.
Since he has to synopsize, it'll just be dead air.
We've got another recent movie for you. This is, I think, the first time we've done a real recent movie since Catching Fire.
It's true.
It's called The Wind Rises, directed by Hayao Miyazaki. Supposed to be his last film, but I think he said that about Howl's Moving Castle as well, and then he made some more, so we'll see. it was released in 2013 and some places, and 2014 and some other places, so 2013, 2014, depending on where you live. On IMDb it'll say 2013, but pretty much if you live in the US, it came out in 2014. And Patrick's going to kick it off with the little plot.
All right. The plot of this movie is basically the story of the life of a man named Jiro Horikoshi, who was the designer of most of the Japanese fighter planes during World War II. It sort of follows a few kind of key episodes in his life, one being him as a child dreaming about the Italian airplane designer Caproni, who actually visits him throughout the film in his dreams and sort of gives him insight into airplanes and their design. It also follows him through the Great Kanto earthquake of, let me see when that was, that was like 1923. Through the Great Depression, the tuberculosis epidemic, and into World War II. And it's really a little bit episodic in a way. It kind of jumps around to like different points in his life and the different people that he meets. But that's basically what the movie is about.
Basil?
I like this movie a lot. I really didn't have very high expectations of it. All the Miyazaki movies that I've revisited recently, for some reason they just didn't hit me the way they used to when I was younger. I saw four of them at a retrospective, I think, 2 years ago, and so I really wasn't expecting too much from this, but I really liked it a lot. It's probably my favorite of the ones that I've seen recently.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say this was necessarily one of my favorites, although I thought it was a really, measured and well-made movie for sure. There were parts of it that were quite affecting for me, and other parts that were less. And while this is a thing that we might have to discuss later, I also thought that there was a little bit of romanticizing involved that felt a little off to me, especially considering that the hero of this story was a guy who was involved in engineering bomber and fighter planes. So, yeah, but that's, you know, I guess we can talk about that later. So I would say I liked it, but not very much.
I also liked it a lot. I was kind of not into it at the beginning, and then really the second half picked up a lot for me. I liked the plain story some, but I liked the Naoko romance a lot.
Yeah, I also really enjoyed this movie. And in particular, I like the way that Miyazaki chooses to focus on these sort of like little insignificant details and kind of really big scenes. Like, there's a scene early where the earthquake happens that he sort of shows all of the effects of the earthquake, sort of the, you know, like the ground waving and the train that they're on, like, you know, coming to a halt and like shaking and everybody like flailing around. And then the way he ends that whole sequence of the earthquake actually happening is he focuses on these little like pebbles coming off of the train tracks, like falling around these little flowers. And it's just this really like serene moment where everything stops and it's just these little flowers and pebbles like rolling around them. And I was just like, that's a really interesting thing to focus on after this, you know, this huge event has just happened. And he did that a couple of times where he would focus on really small details like that. Like the, there's a scene where Jiro, I think, is like throwing this paper airplane with Naoko, and he ends that whole sequence with the German man whose name I forget, who I guess we can get into whether or not he's real or not real. But it focuses on him like actually catching the paper airplane, and then he accidentally crumples it up, and it's just him like looking at the crumpled airplane in his hand. And I love that he did that even in a movie where he's, you know, still going for, I guess not to make a pun, but flights of fancy, where a lot of it is Jiro's actual dreams about airplanes and his visitations from Caproni, who I'm. As far as I know, he didn't actually meet Caproni ever. He just sort of dreamed about meeting him, I guess, according to Miyazaki.
I was going to say, to bring it back to the first thing that you talked about, was one of the main things that I kind of wanted to talk about, which was like that there was something really cool about the sound design in this movie, that it had like kind of an odd like handmade kind of quality to it. Like when those rocks are falling, I noticed, like, unlike real, like, normal Foley work, it actually just sounded like someone shaking rocks in their hand. Like, it had, like, kind of an off-kilter feeling to it. And often, like, the propellers in the movie just sound like someone kind of just going with their mouth. And I really liked that. Like, I thought it was really cool. And there was just, like, a whole bunch of different things like that. It sounded like people just making the sounds, like the... Even that train has kind of like a quality. It's really good.
I wanted to talk about the other scene that Patrick mentioned, which is the one where they're throwing the paper airplane around and how everybody's risking their lives for a sheet of paper for like no reason. It's like, what are you guys doing? Like, Jiro is like standing like 1 foot on his like balcony, one arm on the roof, like trying to grab literally a sheet of paper that it took him about 2 seconds to make.
Yeah, I thought
that kind of is like all you sort of need to know about his personality.
Yeah, I thought that it was really interesting. Like, I didn't realize watching this movie until the very end that Jiro was even a real person. I thought he was just sort of like metaphorical for like a kind of ambivalent feeling about Japan's involvement in the war and the way that war was romanticized during the 30s. And like finding out that he's a real person kind of really impressed me in a way, because it seemed to me that like the depiction of Jiro was very like critical. Like, I didn't think that the movie really had like a kind of lionizing quality where like it shows like some of his problems, but in the end is kind of holding him up as a person. I thought that the movie, like, as far as biopics go, had a really strongly like pointed critique that impressed me a lot. And at the same time, but, like, didn't, like, deny his humanity. Like, it didn't turn him into, like, kind of, like, a monster who created something that killed a whole bunch of people. It was interesting.
Though, what did that critique consist of then? Because I kind of thought that most of the time the movie was definitely kind of showing him to be, definitely showing him in a positive light, in a very positive light, if not even like way too positive.
Really? Mm-hmm. I had like the opposite reaction where, like, to me it seemed like he was constantly like abandoning real responsibilities for this weird dream of making airplanes that kind of doesn't matter. Like, the romance with Naoko, like, he's kind of like treating his wife kind of badly. Like, she's sick and she needs help, and he can't give up his work because he feels like it's so important to, like, be with her and help her to get better. And I mean, I guess, you know, in the end she ends up dying because she wants to be with him, and he can't not work in order to, like, give her the medical attention that she actually needs.
Yeah. But I, although... sorry, again, having kind of audio problem. Wait a sec.
Okay. Well, something that I actually disagree with both of you, in the sense that what I liked about the movie is that I didn't feel like it told you what to think at all. Like, that it just sort of presented, like, these moments or whatever. So I didn't feel like it was a critique or lionizing, that it was just like, this is what happened, and then really it was what you sort of wanted to get out of it, and you got out of it. I was really surprised a lot by how, like, how nothing in the film really seemed to be sort of pushed in, like, a certain direction. Like, a lot of things that I thought would happen didn't. For instance, what was the name of Jiro's friend who also designed planes?
Hanjo was his name.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we're talking about history, not fiction. But I definitely thought that, like, Hanjo was going to become, like, the bad plane designer, and that Jiro was going to become, like, the good plane designer.
Yeah.
That, like, that they, like, set up to be, like, you know, Hanjo cared about, like, Japan moving forward, and Jiro was, like, head in the clouds, you know, like, just cared about the design and whatnot.
Yeah, there was even some false foreshadowing going on there, because, like, when I think the head engineer says to him, you shouldn't involve Hanjo in your project because you guys are gonna lose your friendship, and then they totally don't. So yeah, that's definitely pretty good.
And, like, stuff like that, to me, it just seemed like, yeah, like, they were people, in a way.
Yeah.
And the like, stuff just happened. I don't know. I really liked, it took me a second to understand what he was talking about, but in the one dream with Caproni, where the, he's like, would you rather have a world with or without the pyramid? And I think what he was saying is, like, you know, the pyramids are so beautiful, and, like, amazing, or, but they're also connected with, like, great tragedy, because they were built by enormous amounts of slave labor.
Yeah.
That, you know, he's like, I would like a world with the pyramid that, like, I don't know, that I guess tragedy doesn't make something completely worthless or something. I didn't feel like it was lionizing, but just, like, I don't know. I can't explain it better than Miyazaki. I thought that line worked really well. Would you like a world with or without the pyramid?
Yeah.
So,
I also felt like there were scenes where he was being pretty critical of, and I mean, I think he even embodies it in the character of Jiro's sister, who actually, like, outright says to him, you know, you can't even leave your work for your wife, who, you know, she needs to be in the mountains, she needs to be recuperating at, like, the sanatorium or whatever, because she's you know, she's got tuberculosis and she's in the city where there's all, and there's even a scene where he starts like smoking in the room with her, and I was like, that's maybe the worst thing you could do for somebody with tuberculosis, like start smoking in the same room with them. So I did think there were some scenes where he wasn't like being very obvious about it, but he was sort of showing that Jiro was being kind of selfish.
Yeah, well, that's her. Their whole relationship in the end was more or less, I mean, you could say he was being critical or being not critical. I guess maybe in a way what Ruben is saying is right, that he does not really take a clear stance one way or the other, just rather presents it as the way that it is, and the way that it is that Naoko kind of which I loved that part too. That was the part of the movie that I liked best. But still, I kind of felt like in that part, Naoko is playing the woman that is kind of used as a kind of a muse character, and then literally disappears into thin air. And it like she helps him create this magical airplane, and then kind of dies after that. And like, is that like the most? Isn't that like a typically she's being instrumentalized in a sort of way for his for his growth as an artist?
Yeah, but it's a growth as an artist to kill people, like,
right?
I mean,
right.
I think that like to me it seemed that the movie was humanizing of the character, but it still seemed like ultimately, especially based on Miyazaki's like whole oeuvre, that he is like very staunchly anti-war, and that like he understands why human beings end up in conflict, but it doesn't. To me, it just seemed like he was.
Yeah. So. I guess maybe this movie is about how you can be against war but pro bombers, pro fighter airplanes.
No,
I don't think he was pro airplanes.
Yeah, I think that like the metaphor of having your head in the clouds and this like romantic idea of what flying, like, to me, walking into this movie, I was like, okay, it's called The Wind Rises. It's about a like young pilot. I was like, okay, it's just going to be Miyazaki like indulging this like love of flying that he's explored in almost all his movies, and it's just like going to be him at his most indulgent. And then like the movie kind of blew me away in how like ambivalent he seemed even about the idea of like creating big planes, because like the military is driving all this so-called art, and that like everything that's being built is being built to like kill other people, and that's like at what point, I don't know, is it still worth it? And I don't know.
I think it's important that until like the very last planes, that like every plane, even the ones sometimes in his dreams, like tear apart and blow up.
Yeah.
Like they're constantly. Like the art is like being destroying itself,
yeah.
In a way. I think that lends some ambivalence to the creation of planes as well.
Yeah, though I think he's definitely making a difference between the individual artists, so to speak, so the plane designers, like the German, what's his name, Junkers, and Jiro himself.
I just read it as Junkers.
Junkers. Yeah.
I was like, what a terrible name for a guy who designs planes.
Right. And the Italian guy also, that those guys are kind of seen.
Cabroni.
That those guys are kind of seen as separate from what the government instrumentalizes their work for. You know?
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what
I think that it's sort of also important that those are also the other two Axis powers. Like, you know, Americans and British people were also designing planes at the same time. And I think that Miyazaki's choice to focus on Germany and Italy you know, I mean, I'm sure it has some also historical connection, but he could have broadened it out if he wanted to, and that he chose not to. Kind of, I don't know, like, I think that the fact that Jiro kind of lionizes these guys points to a kind of ambivalence about his character, that he wants to see it as being separate, that, like, you know, he's, like, excited about the plane, and he's like, you know, we can get it to go this fast if we don't put guns on it, but the idea is that they're gonna put guns on it, like, that's the whole point of the plane, is to put guns on it, so, like, he wants to separate this art into something that has nothing to do with its eventual intention, but I think that Miyazaki sees him as being naive for believing that.
And kind of emotionless from a lot of the movie in a weird way. Like, probably one of my favorite scenes in the movie is the earthquake scene, and when he meets Naoko and is that her aunt or something?
I
originally thought it was her mother, but later she said that her mother died of tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It may have been her aunt. I think it may have been like her housemaid or something like that, because I think she talks about her housemaid having another child later, and so I think that may have been that who that character was.
Yeah, if the person that she talked about having another child was her. So if that was the housemaid,
yeah, I think that's who it was. I think that was her housemaid.
Okay, so and Jiro, like the housemaid, I guess, like breaks her leg, and Jiro puts together a quick. What would you call that?
Splint.
A quick splint using like his level or something.
It's his big ruler that he uses for drawing.
For his engineering work, and then helps carry her to her home, and then just sort of like disappears without like getting any thanks or something. And that's like a lot of sort of what I thought was interesting about the movie was summed up in like that scene where I was like, okay, like I sort of get this character now. He's like, straightforward but heroic and like really noble or something, but like he doesn't like take part in the emotion. And then later when Naoko like comes back and like leaves something for him, he's like really excited to see her and misses her. He doesn't get to see her. And I was like, wait, if you're really excited to see her, why didn't you stick around for like 5 seconds earlier when you saved them? And he's like, I've been in love with you since you caught my hat. And I was like, but you didn't want to say hello? Like, after you carried this woman back to our house with Naoko? And, like, that kind of, like, the inability to, like, see the real world. I didn't see it as, like, noble after that scene. I saw it as, like, you know, like, he doesn't really know how to live in a way that made me kind of sad for him.
Yeah. Mhm. I agree. With that.
It seemed like he was a character who had like a strong sense of justice, but he didn't really get like the details of the human emotion involved in the situations. Like he was like, okay, this is what's, you know, this is right, and this is what I should do. But then he was just like completely deaf to all the other things that were happening around it. Like he was.
So does everyone else that he sees kind of tells him that this is the right thing to do, right? Like, even Naoko's father is like, well, the man's first obligation is to his job. So that's when he decides to not be with her, but returns to work on his plane design. And then the people at his company are also reminding him that basically his main obligation is to them first before to anyone else. So actually, like, more or less everyone in this movie is kind of telling him that he's doing the right thing, even though, except for his little sister, who's the only kind of voice of rebellion there. And I guess you can say that that is like the moral center of the movie, his little sister, but she's in the movie like 3 times. And like every time it's like, oh right, she exists. I kind of forgot about her. You know, so it's kind of hard to say that's what the movie's really driving at.
God, let Patrick talk.
I was going to say, I think that it's interesting, the character of his sister, because I feel like she, every time she comes in the movie, like, she is always, like, berating Jiro for something that he's doing. Like, she's always like, hey, come, you should come play with me. Come, you know, come hang out. She's like, what are you doing? And he's like, I want to read airplane magazines or whatever. And she, and then she's like, you should, you know, be with your wife and not be doing your job. And he's like, I have to finish, you know, my dreams or whatever. And it, it's almost like she is, I don't know, like, a conduit for, like, Miyazaki being like, you know, you should do this thing. And, you know, the character's like, no, no, no. And it's like he's having an argument with himself in those moments, because it's like him, like, you know, examining both sides of the coin of, like, yes, I love these. It's almost like he's examining his own, you know, love of film, and also at the same time, like, the, I don't know, the kind of violence that is also portrayed in some of his films and the stuff like that, where it's like,
and the fact that he can't live his life while he's making these enormous films, maybe.
Yeah, also that too. Yeah. And I also like that the design for the character of his sister looks very similar to the main character from Spirited Away. So it's almost like he's got this, like, stock character that he's brought back and put in the movie. Like, she's a grown-up version of that same character.
I was gonna say, in a way, it's almost like, like, most of the movie is this weird dream that Jiro is having, and, like, she's almost like a mom character being like, wake up, Jiro, the real world's out here. And he's like, no, I'm going back to sleep, mom, leave me alone.
I think there is actually a scene where his mom wakes him up, or he's, like, having a dream, and somebody's saying something to him, and he's like, hi, and he's like, you know, like, he's actually saying it in real life, and his mom's like, you were dreaming very loudly, or something like that.
He was also asleep on the floor in that scene, which I thought was a nice little detail early on about what his character was like, is that he just fell asleep on the floor instead of his bed, and his mom was like, let's get you into your bed, and you're gonna be asleep.
Yeah, another detail, what Basil mentioned earlier about the sound design, which I also kind of thought was pretty nice, was the coughing on the soundtrack, which did not, if I'm correct, it did not really start when Naoko tells him about her tuberculosis, but already earlier. Like, I heard coughing on the soundtrack of this movie a couple times at like really weird junctures, and I was like, wait, did I just hear someone cough? Was that like,
I thought it was Joel for like a long time.
I was like, was that some of the people who were like recording the voices, did they just cough into the mic and they just kept it in? And then later,
no, I think it was metaphorical.
Yeah, right. And then it was later it became obvious that that was the whole point, but I thought that was kind of great, like you were just kind of messing with your mind while you were watching it in this really interesting but kind of simplistic way. But at the same time, I was also really impressed with the sound design, and also, like, it kind of reminded me of what I really like about Lynch's movies, which is also in some ways reminded me of this movie. Namely, there were like, so the sound design reminded me of Lynch in the way that I felt was really surprising, and like how the earthquake was like supported by this kind of wail that seemed like it was coming from some kind of monster or whatever, but then was revealed to be the fire or something like that. That was one thing that I associated with Lynch, and the other thing was kind of like the way the characters spoke in this really straightforward manner about things like, isn't he a nice young gentleman? You know, with like that, like just in that matter. Except with Lynch, this comes with a weird like sense of irony. Here it was just like, no, they really mean that about him. Yes, he's a fine young gentleman, right? And I kind of, I don't know, like I felt like that was really like, this movie really did not really have this focus on like, okay, this is what I'm interested in. I don't really care if anyone else maybe even gets it. Like, I'm kind of interested in showing people like this, and if you don't care about that, then I don't care.
to, like, I guess tie your, like, coughing point to, like, my earlier point, is that it was, to me, another reminder of the way in which this film, like, didn't hold your hand or, like, tell you where to go. Like, there were a lot of times where, like, for a long time it wasn't clear whether or not something was a dream or real life or, like, what had actually happened or, like, you know, when it jumped forward in time from Jiro as a child to, like, Jiro, like, off going off to school, like, there was no indication that time had gone forward. Mm-hmm. And, like, I didn't know who that was on the train for, like, a second. And then, like, I was like, oh, that's Jiro. He has similar glasses or whatever. But then the completely different actor started talking. And I was like, is that Jiro? And, like, I really like that about this film, that it was just sort of like, I'm gonna, like, do my thing, and if you like it, that's cool, and if you don't like it, that's cool, too.
I think it's pretty amazing in a way that this movie was, like, dubbed and released by Disney, because it's hard for me to imagine, like, what the age barrier is for actually, like, appreciating this movie. Like, it seems like it would be really boring and strange to be, like, 7 and watch this, but I could be wrong. I don't know. Like, everything that was going on about the plot seemed so adult and, like, kind of tied really closely to at least some knowledge of, you know, history and World War II and what happened before World War II, that I thought it was pretty awesome that he was willing to make it, like, not dumbed down for kids, but, you know, tell a pretty serious story and not, like, I don't know. It didn't feel Pixar'd in the way that, like, it's trying to appeal to two different audiences at the same time, but, like, you could tell which parts are which are for which audience.
Yeah, I will say, I think there's a contingent at Disney because so many, or I guess because of all the Studio Ghibli films have sort of been released under the, I guess, the Buena Vista distribution banner.
Sure. Uh-huh.
I think there's a large contingent of just, like, the animators and people who work at Disney who have, like, a really great appreciation of Miyazaki. Because I remember back when Spirited Away came out, like, there was a really big push from a lot of them to actually get it, like, released and distributed widely so that it could compete in the Oscars. And he did end up winning the Oscar that year for Best Animated Feature, so I think that I'm glad that Disney has an appreciation for more adult oriented animation like this, even if it's coming from a studio that's not theirs. Like, I'm glad that they at least have that appreciation of it.
Right. I was more just related to this specific movie because to me, Spirited Away seems like there's a pretty good entry point for children. Like, the main character is a child. It's kind of easy to focus your point of view into that character versus, like, and that's how this movie starts, and I thought that's how it was going to keep going for the whole movie. So, like Ruben, I was very surprised when suddenly Jiro was an adult and remained an adult for the rest of the film.
Yeah.
There's, like, going to be a half second of an advertisement in this podcast because I opened a website and it started autoplaying.
Oh, no.
I didn't hear it.
I did not hear it.
You will hear it on the podcast.
Nice.
delete.
Especially now that I drew attention to it.
Well, I'll be
rewind and
edit.
Go back and be like, "Where's the ad?"
I'm gonna edit the shit out of that ad. Edit the shit out of that.
When I was going into watching this movie, I was kind of worried. It had been a long time since I had seen a Miyazaki film, and sort of all I could remember from his films, in a way, was, like, everyone's sort of, like, these, like, long pauses between everyone speaking, like, every sentence everyone was saying was, like, really intensely emotional. And I was kind of worried that this film was going to be that, because that was all that I could remember. And then, like, the first, like, 10 minutes of this movie, like, almost nobody talks at all.
Yeah.
There's just, like, no talking. And I was like, That's cool. I like when movies like hold off on talking for like a really long time. It's like you're either gonna be in this world or not. We're not gonna, like, you know.
Yeah. It was pretty talky afterwards. I made that note too. Like the first 5 or 10 minutes, it was like there was almost no speaking, and then after that, it was just wall to wall dialogue the whole time. But I guess by then, you were either into it or you weren't, and that's fair, I guess. But there was also like this is something that I tried to notice, like the Japanese speaker, like the main guy who was speaking for Jiro, I thought like his delivery compared to the others was really, really markedly different. Like he sounded almost like he was reading from a book rather than speaking it, you know, like he was really like his delivery was very, not, I wouldn't say monotonous, but like definitely markedly different than the other actors. And I was wondering whether that had any kind of specific additional kind of idea, but it probably went along with him being such a, in a way, kind of a stunted character, you know, like emotionally stunted, and also like just incapable of maybe what we talked about earlier, maybe incapable of really kind of understanding certain aspects about life the way others did. But it was hard to tell because obviously I don't speak Japanese, so I couldn't really derive too much from that. But I was wondering whether that had an additional kind of meaning to it. Okay. And if you guys had noticed that too.
Are you talking about the guy that voices him as an adult, right?
Yeah.
Because there's two different. Sure. Yeah, because there's another voice actor for him as a child.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Basil. you go ahead.
All right, it's my birthday. I'm going ahead. I really liked that. That was something that I noticed too. That it seemed like a very conscious decision, and that like. Compared to how I perceive a lot of like my experience with a lot of like Japanese voice acting in anime stuff is that could be like really over the top really easily, and that just like the amount of restraint and like characterization that goes into not just like what he's saying but how he's saying it, It did add to the kind of like dreamy aspect to it of his character, and the way it was kind of like that he wasn't fully present in the situation almost ever. Mm-hmm. Like that he's always kind of thinking about airplanes.
Yeah.
Trying to have a regular conversation.
Yeah, and I thought it was funny too. Or not funny necessarily, but it was interesting the way they show earlier in the film where he's on the roof with his sister looking at the stars, and he like takes his glasses off and he's like, I can see things more clearly this way or something like that, and she's like, look at the shooting stars, and he like can't see them at all, and instead he's like visualizing the stars as like airplanes, whatever. I thought that was really interesting. Like an interesting metaphor for the way that he like saw everything as kind of like the like exactly what he wanted to see as opposed to the way it really was. And I thought it was interesting that they tied his myopia to that aspect of his personality too, whereas like he's got this physical condition that sort of mirrors his emotional condition.
Point.
Yeah, and I also to what you were saying about the I can't remember, I think it was Ruben who was saying earlier how they're like risking their lives for that little piece of paper in that one scene, that also ties into him sort of like having no regard for real responsibility as opposed to his kind of flights of fancy where he's, you know, standing on his tiptoe on this balcony in this scene where you think he's about to just plummet to his death because he's like reaching out really precariously, and the handrail below him like breaks when he sees Naoko. He's like, "Naoko," and then it's like break, and you're like, "Oh my god, he's gonna fall down!" And then he like grabs with one hand at the last second, and it's like the movie's not even really that concerned with him maybe dying. It's just he's just like hanging there, like, "Hey, what's up?" You know, just like, and then he just like gets back onto the edge really easily. You're just like, "Wow, that was really dangerous and horrible of him," but he somehow managed to like shrug it off like it was nothing. I don't know. I think in a way that Miyazaki may be making like a larger point about Japanese culture as well, like the kind of, I don't know, like muted emotions of, you know, just like the society in general, where they're like, "Oh, well, let's not make too big a deal out of things." I kept thinking about Tokyo Story. We were watching this where, you know, in that same way, it has those like muted emotions where people should probably be feeling really distraught about things, but they just don't out of politeness. And so you get...
What was that Setsuko Hara gift that Basil found? It's like, "Life is pretty miserable, isn't it?" And she's like, "Yes, it is."
Yes, it is. While smiling really big. Yes, it is. Life is really disappointing. Yes, it is.
Yeah, I think...
Good film moment.
Yeah, I was going to say that, tying back to what Ilya was talking about, as far as like the way that everyone supports his decision, including his wife, to me felt more just like the way that like Miyazaki is looking at this odd kind of valorization of work that came in like the post-industrial era. Like, I mean, I think Japan is like most sort of stereotyped for it, but it comes in every culture. American culture, everyone is like, working is what men need to do. It's their being productive. You're producing for your country, for your company, for like that. Your identity is very distinctly tied to what you can produce for the world, even if it's something terrible. So like, you know, that that everyone is behind him doesn't seem like Miyazaki supporting it so much as him looking at like how, you know, I mean, I think that maybe that could even be like the question that he started with. He's like, how did this guy get to this place where he designed these things that just killed thousands of people? Like, what kind of a person ends up there? And then, you know, that it all comes down to like cultural things and his own personal ambitions and just the way that certain feats of humanity are romanticized, and especially in young people's eyes. I mean, like, I was obsessed with planes and stuff like that when I was a kid. Planes and dinosaurs, yeah. Big stuff that, you know, like,
yeah,
that kicks ass.
I agree with you all the way up until that last point. Like, I agree with you about everything else that you said, that's all kind of a product of the way that people saw work and the meaning of work. And like, I mean, for Japan, the same as for Germany especially, it was pretty much the same thing. But I don't think the movie really shows like the impact of the planes that he built in terms of what the civilian impact of that was, of how many deaths that caused, because the only thing you see in the end was these piles of blown up airplanes that is kind of sad to look at. And you see at the and you look at the and there's like the pilots that start off into the sky, and he says, "Oh, none of these pilots came back alive." Like, yeah, sure, that's kind of what's the sad thing. Not like the cost of the war in terms of what the Japanese caused, but what like was caused to Japan. Like, so it's kind of one-sided, I thought, at least. I felt like,
well,
it was...
I think that, yeah, I would say that I disagree with that, only in the sense that I feel like maybe World War II, like how horrible it was, can just be inferred. I think that like showing it doesn't always work. Like, for me, the Saving Private Ryan doesn't work nearly as well as it should, considering how awful it is. But I don't know. Like, for me, like, even just the idea that none of those people came back alive is sad in and of itself. It's awful. Like, those are people that had some kind of dream that they were doing something good, and they're just gone. They're dead. And you know, like, it didn't amount to anything. Like, it was all basically for nothing, and that makes me
yeah,
sad.
the only problem I have with that is the fact that Japan is part of the Axis, with Germany and Italy was part of the aggressors of the Second World War.
Sure.
So taking the rest of that out of that equation,
liked that we got to see kind of a sympathetic portrait. I don't know. I know that they're the villains. Like, I guess I just know that.
Yeah.
I know that a lot, in a way. Like, I know that all over the place.
Because, America...
To me, it was just nice to see, like, the other thing. Like, all I ever see is just, like, you know, innocent victims and Americans dying at the hands of the Axis powers in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I don't know, I was okay with it being sort of like a little more middle of the road. But I do want to say that when you said you disagreed with Basil's last point, it sounded like you were saying you disagreed with that Basil liked dinosaurs and planes as a kid.
I very
strongly disagree with that point. I know exactly what you liked back then, Basil. It definitely wasn't planes.
In essence, I agree with you, Ilya, in that maybe it could have done a better job of, like, showing those things. But on the other hand, just in my own personal cultural experience, like, I'm kind of tired of it in a way. And I was like, all right, I like seeing a somewhat sympathetic portrait of the quote-unquote villains.
Yeah, my personal thing comes here because in a weird way there's been a development in Germany of kind of sentimentalizing their own past, and I'm very, very cautious and of that sort of sentimentalization. And so whenever I see movies, like, if, like, they're, I don't know, like, that's why I kind of get really a little anxious whenever that sort of thing happens. Obviously, everyone knows what happened in the Second World War. You can, I guess, assume that about any movie made about that subject. I still think that there's a kind of thing that I guess you should, the things that you don't show are also just the things that don't exist within your movie. You know,
So what do you think about? There's a scene where he's in Germany and there's like some cops like chasing somebody.
Yeah.
So I assume it's a soon-to-be victim of the Holocaust. I don't know who that kid is.
Yeah.
And they're like, go back to Japan, Japanese or whatever. Didn't you kind of feel like that scene was sort of pointing out how Jiro is just not paying attention to like?
Yeah.
The victims.
Yeah.
In a way, definitely. I felt like actually that scene was very effective also at saying something about that situation without being very overt about it. I thought that scene was quite good in that sense. Because it was actually, I think, the time at which they're in Germany. What time is that?
I believe it's the 30s. It's during the Great Depression.
The war has not started yet.
No, the war has definitely not started yet. So it's
like, going too soon.
Yeah, it's really vague, and like Junkers, I think, is still I think they just met him or whatever, and he's still like playing a big role in what and the militarization. So I think that's just the beginning of Hitler's regime. So what was going on there was shown in a way that's actually very evocative and very, very good, without pointing out, oh yeah, right, Nazis and so on and so forth, you know, without acting like a signifier for Nazism, It doesn't have to be that. And not all scenes have to be that way. And I like that, definitely. And it does show him to be kind of unaware in one way, because he just doesn't react to that in any way besides, ugh, that's weird, and then the next scene comes.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I mean, I agree with you that, like, sentimentalizing Germany's past and even Japan's past is very something you should be very cautious about, but I think that there's a way in which, like, the traditional depictions of them as just, like, sort of inhuman monsters who did horrible things, like, makes it too easy, and it makes it too easy to, like, I guess in a way let things like that continue to perpetuate, because if you create a world in which someone has to be a horrible human being in order to do these horrible things, no one is ever going to hold themselves culpable of being capable of horribleness. But if you see someone as a human being who's kind of just caught up in a particular culture, and that this sways them almost without them even realizing it, it can maybe help create a world where people are becoming more aware of what's going on around them, and, like, maybe,
sure,
you know, not participating without.
Yeah, well, I agree with that 100%. I agree with that 100%.
And I thought that this
actually
movie did a good job of.
Yeah, in that same vein, most of the Germans in this movie were kind of presented these, like, robotic, like, screaming guardsmen, but there was one German in particular who, like, I think Patrick already talked about it a little bit, who seemed like a dream character, not really quite real, a person who Jiro meets during the second time that he meets his future wife, who is critical of the German regime himself, or seems to be, and is kind of a really mystifying figure, really. Like, in a way, I'm not sure what his purpose is.
Yeah, I thought he was supposed to represent the kind of, like, emigre, like, Germans that all kind of, like, left the country when Hitler was coming to power. They were like, I know where this is going. This is not going to be good for me as someone who doesn't want to be a Nazi, so I'm going to leave. And they can kind of see that where the tide is turning, and that's, like, why he's kind of filled with this, I guess, portentousness in the way that he talks about where the world is headed.
I thought it was really weird the way you see him before you really meet him, because it's like he's looking, like, Jiro is looking across the room at Naoko and her father, who are sitting at this other table, but he's that character who, I think his name is Castor, I think that's what his name is, but he's, like, sitting in between them, and he's very prominently placed in the scene. And then he's, like, just, like, eating mouthfuls of this, like, grass-like stuff. I didn't know what that was supposed
to be.
Yeah,
it's like a bush. It's like a bush in a bowl.
He looks like he's just, like, a cow, just, like, putting all this, like, I was like, that
with
is
wine.
Such a weird, yeah, he's got wine and this, like, I don't know what that was supposed to be, if it was, like, some sort of shoot that was edible, or
it doesn't look like human food.
Yeah, it looked like it was like a bush. It was, yeah, it was so weird looking. But, like, seeing him and then, like, seeing him show up in the movie, I was like, this is a very weird character, and he doesn't really, I don't know, it seems like he says stuff to other people, but they don't ever speak back to him except for Jiro. I can't remember if Naoko's father actually speaks back to him or not, but it almost seems like
I can't remember either.
It almost seems like Jiro's the only one who sees him sometimes, because he's like sitting at the table with Jiro and Naoko's father, but it seems like only Jiro and Naoko's father are speaking to each other, and he's just sort of there, like, throwing off these kind of, you know, pontifications on, you know, what a good marriage they'll have, or, you know, what a good man Jiro is, or stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought that he was real, but that the fact that everyone was kind of ignoring him was part of the point, is that, like, if everyone's eyes were open, they would see this turning tide is coming, that things are not going well, they're going badly, and that everyone's just like, well, we're not paying attention to what you have to say. Like,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mr. Rabbit Food.
Yeah, even this song that he plays on the piano is from a 1930s German movie or German play, I think. I don't know. Like, I definitely remember that song.
That's right.
As discussing that song, so that goes along with your idea that he's this typically like seen to be this typical German emigre guy. So he represents the Weimar Republic and all of its kind of the last gasp of its like artistic and scientific virtues, and also like those people who were representing Germany's best and brightest or whatever, suddenly not knowing where to go, and kind of going in every which direction just to flee. So that definitely makes sense. That's true.
What was I going to say? I lost it. There's something about... the music. Yeah. There was like a... one of the songs that played is very similar to a song in Noriko's Dinner Table, and it made me wonder if it was like just a classic like Japanese song, or if there was for some reason some actual connection between the composers of the two movies.
No.
I did not.
Interesting.
I did not look it up.
I can look
it up. And since I think Ruben is the only other person that's seen that movie, I guess
Joe Hisaishi is the guy who did the music. He does, I think he's done the music for a lot of his movies.
The music was very multicultural, though. There was a French song and a German song and an Italian song.
He is a very prolific composer, though. Joe Hisaishi is. It doesn't look like he did Noriko's Dinner Table. But he has 94 credits as a composer, so he's a very, very prolific Japanese composer.
Wow.
Can I say something that will sound like I'm being sarcastic, but I'm actually being serious?
All the time.
Yeah.
One of my favorite parts of the podcast is when we Google stuff.
100%.
We've now entered the Googling section of the podcast.
Yes, we have.
I actually already had IMDb up, so I didn't need to use Google for that.
I just Googled that, though, which is the song that I'm referring to. I just posted it in the chat. You can listen to it later.
Yeah.
I don't really have that much more to say about this movie, but I will say that the shot of Naoka in her wedding gear, like when the door opens and she's revealed, was like maybe my favorite shot in any Miyazaki film that I've seen. Like, I thought it was like unbelievably gorgeous. I don't know if it has any meaning. It could have just been a very stereotypical Japanese, like, snow falling, you know, bride shot or whatever, but I just thought it was really, really gorgeous.
I agree with that.
I did think he put in a special emphasis on that shot. Like, I felt it when I watched it. I was like, oh, wow, he really thinks that this shot is important when I saw it. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, yeah, it's very good. And I think it was also, it was part of it was Jiro's reaction to seeing her, too. Like, they cut back to him, and his reaction is just like he can't breathe for a second. And
it's
I thought that
the
was a really
Jiro
good
version of the wolf with the eyes popping out of his head and his tongue rolling down to the ground. And like, oh,
yeah.
And like hitting the table.
Yeah.
I really love the shot of the plane shaving the clouds, or like the clouds kind of coming over like I don't know what, but like the plane kind of flying through them, and the clouds kind of covering the plane a little bit, and just the plane cutting through them like they were made out of some substance that can be cut
thicker than something thicker
like
than
like a
moisture.
Knife through butter.
Yeah, I agree with that. I thought that was one of the cool things in the way that it created a kind of ambivalence, because there was something really beautiful about, like, the planes and that weird, ridiculous plane that Caproni develops.
Oh, yeah, yeah, like, the giant with, like, Italian,
like,
transport
10
plane.
10 wings or whatever it was.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of
and the plane is so Fellini-esque, too. Like, everyone is constantly, like, falling out of every window.
Right.
Like,
they're just so
I'm surprised
to be in that plane. That
I'm surprised we haven't mentioned, or maybe not that surprised, because none of us probably like that movie. I'm surprised no one has mentioned The Aviator in comparison to this. Because that's...
I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it either.
That's like... Oh, okay. That's even easier then, as a reason.
I've seen it.
Yeah. So, like...
I actually haven't seen very many Scorsese films. I don't know why, really. But I've seen Raging Bull and his comedies, and that's like it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And that, well, that one drama was enough to turn you off from all his dramas.
Yeah.
No, I liked it when I first saw it.
Oh, really?
I felt like that's like the... Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say I liked Raging Bull the first time I saw it, and then the second time I saw it, I was like, I can't stand this movie, and I turned it off after 40 minutes because every scene felt like the same scene. It was like Robert De Niro just getting really angry about something very small.
I feel like
yelling.
The scene where De Niro bangs his head against a prison wall is like, there should be one of those YouTube 10-hour cuts of just that happening. Like saying, no, no, no. Just hitting his head
just
against the wall.
Punching the wall,
For 10 hours. That movie kind of, I think, predicted that sort of stuff to be happening. Because I remember when I watched that film with my parents and we started laughing when that happened, I figured that this was not really working the way it was intended to work.
Were you going to say something about The Aviator?
Yeah, like that. I feel like that was... like the most obvious kind of mainstream equivalent of this movie already, like, having existed before Miyazaki made this movie, because I guess it was kind of like pretty bombastic and also like so focused on like the visual experience of airplane flying and how like exquisite airplanes look and how like that's such an innate thing for film to be focused on. But I felt like this movie did not remind... I didn't even think of The Aviator at first, only very much later when I kind of... when actually, the moment when the Italian... I forget his name.
Caproni,
right. When he makes this huge, huge, like, thing that falls apart rather than flying off, that reminded me of Howard Hughes's huge water plane or whatever that never really took off.
Yeah,
and it was a huge disaster. Yeah,
it's the Hercules.
Exactly.
The part when he grabs the like film and he like opens the canister and starts throwing the film into the water.
Yeah. Exactly.
I thought it was I thought that scene was interesting because I thought it was supposed to be reality at first, and then he like turns around and just starts talking to Jiro, and I was like, oh, this is a dream. I thought this was real.
I thought that was interesting too from a filmic perspective, because it's like all the stuff that's not good, again, I guess with quotes around it, gets thrown out.
Just throw it away.
Reminds you of all the failures that you don't see when you're watching a film.
Right.
Like, it's 2 hours of successes and, you know, thousands of hours of failures.
And the, I mean, the way that history gets told, too, that we throw out the parts we don't want to see.
Yeah, or the parts that don't fit in with the narrative, basically.
Right.
I also thought another interesting thing was the thing where that he mentions in the movie about the... which might just be not even seriously intended, but he says about that every artist or whatever gets like 10 good years in which they make good art, and I thought it was funny to think about whether Miyazaki considers this still part of those 10 years, this movie, or whether or not this is already past it or whatever, because he made Princess Mononoke in like 19 97,
yeah.
And he made a bunch of movies before that and a bunch of movies after that. And I don't know where those 10 years.
He's for like 30 years.
Yeah.
Where?
It's true, yeah. He's been making movies since the 70s.
Yeah. So I don't know where his 10 years fit in there.
If he actually believes that.
I mean, if he actually believes that, obviously.
That could also just be a way that it's, you know, the way that cultures tend to value, like, young contributions and marginalized people who are older. But
right.
That you are no longer, especially in terms of militaristic cultures, that the young men are what's important more than any other facet of society. But who knows? Could be reading too much into that.
Yeah. Who knows?
Maybe he feels that he's past his prime and that's why he keeps threatening to retire. Although,
right.
Considering how much I like this movie, I actually hope he makes another one.
Yeah, especially considering how much I didn't like Howl's Moving Castle. I did like this movie much better than Howl's Moving Castle. That's for sure.
I haven't seen it since the theater, but I also remember being disappointed by it.
Yeah.
That's one I haven't seen of his.
Is there one between Howl's Moving Castle and this? I thought there was.
Yeah, I think
Ponyo.
Ponyo. Ponyo, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I saw that one too. Did not like it.
Oops. Is The Secret Life of Arrietty, is that like just Studio Ghibli?
That's Studio Ghibli. That's not him, though. I think he was like a producer on it.
Wasn't it his son or something?
That's what I thought.
I think his son did one called From Up on Poppy Hill.
Oh, that's right.
I don't...
Let's just speculate about Studio Ghibli.
Let's
go back to the Googling portion.
Googling portion.
Well, I was going to say, The Secret World of Arrietty is directed by Hiromasa Yonebayashi. So that's somebody... That's, I guess, another director who works for Studio Ghibli, but let me see here if Miyazaki was a producer on that one, because he probably was.
I saw his name on a poster.
Yeah, it's probably like...
Financial contributions made by Hayao Miyazaki.
Ooh.
Should go see this. He gave $10 to the film.
Hayao Miyazaki stopped by the studio to say he was doing a good job. I don't see his name in the credits anywhere. Maybe it's just like... Yeah, there he is. Okay, sorry. He's an executive producer on that one. So
raised money. We were all along.
Money.
He was a name connected to it
from the same studio that employs Hayao Miyazaki.
I always think it's funny when
you loved it.
Remember My Neighbor Totoro? Didn't you like that movie?
Yeah, I always think it's funny when trailers are really grasping at straws and they say from the studio that brought you.
Yeah,
like, none of the creative people involved with that. Like,
I bet a lot of people go like, "Oh,
literally
right,
just the place,
that studio."
Although that's funny. Yeah.
Filmed in the same city as Vertigo.
It's kind of tiresome to me though when I see like comedy trailers that are like from the acclaimed director that saw this other movie. It's like, I was like, oh, that's dumb. I can't remember what movie that was that did that, but that was part of their trailer. It was like, from some guy who probably saw this movie.
It's like, it's like a
tangentially connected to something else. I was just like,
that was back when like Chungking Express was advertised as being recommended by Quentin Tarantino or whatever.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
When that Zhang Yimou movie Hero came out, literally everyone I talked to at my job thought that Quentin Tarantino directed it because the way they advertised it was Quentin Tarantino presents Hero.
Yeah. So good. So good.
Oh boy.
They should just do that with countries.
As someone who really liked Zhang Yimou and was kind of over Tarantino at that point. I was like, come on, it's not even the same.
They should just do, from the country that brought you samurai swords.
When Richard Linklater put out Killer of Sheep, his name was like not on it at all, so I thought that was cool.
That's good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I heard that Tarantino didn't actually want his name on it, but Miramax, it was like part of their... movie's not going to make any money unless we put your name on it, so we're not going to release it unless...
I'm sure that was a Harvey Weinstein call.
Like, Miramax are like the only people who can make Tarantino look humble by comparison.
Yeah.
Alright.
Alright.
Oh, I was going to say that I thought of The Aviator 2 and that that movie is definitely terrible in comparison to this one because of the way that it absolutely lionizes at almost every opportunity how great and genius and witty and charming Howard Hughes was as a creepy, crazy person.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And completely forgets how fucking racist and terrible he was, yes.
And how, like, he also designed planes that ended up killing lots of people, probably.
Yes, and was really proud of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Man. What do you think Martin Scorsese's favorite war was? That's a reference. I don't know if you guys know it too, but Basil told me this burn that Jonathan Rosenbaum said about Steven Spielberg as still one of my favorite things, which is that it was like he's the type of person who could tell you what his favorite war is or something like that.
That was that was a joke in Small Soldiers, where Phil Hartman like turns on the TV and he's like trying all the channels and it like turns to a war movie and he turns around and goes, I think World War II was my favorite war. That was hilarious when I was little.
Yeah, I think that Jonathan Rosenbaum was talking about... he was probably referencing that Joe Dante line, but since he's a big fan. But yeah, I think it was specific. And he was talking about Saving Private Ryan and that Steven Spielberg seems like the kind of person who would say World War II was my favorite war.
Yeah, yeah.
Spielberg burns in at the end.
That Steven Spielberg kind of jabs in.
Director that I like. And yes. Yeah, made two films on our canon.
Yeah. It's, yeah. I was going to say, it's interesting. I was thinking of, like, how to describe Miyazaki to people because I was watching this on set the other day and somebody asked me what I was watching and I was kind of like, well, yeah, I was kind of like looking for a comparison to like a filmmaker that they would probably know, and I was like, I think he's kind of the Japanese Steven Spielberg because his movies have been like incredibly successful in Japan. Like, I think for a while there, one of his movies was like the highest grossing film in the history of Japan.
Princess Mononoke.
Was that the one? Okay. Yeah, because
Princess Mononoke made more money in Japan than Titanic made in America.
That, I believe it. Yeah. That's basically like who he is. He's like, I don't know, I guess, I don't know if James Cameron would be an apt comparison though. It seems like he's more prolific than Cameron. He's more prolific in the way.
I don't know if his style is the same. He deals with a lot of the same themes as Spielberg, though.
Yeah.
Another loose cannons Googling alert here. The Wind Rises was the highest grossing box office hit of Japan of 2013. So
makes sense.
He keeps on making them, and he keeps on winning that box office.
I believe it,
Mr. Miyazaki.
He is the Steven Spielberg of Japan.
I mean, he deals a lot with innocence and, like, nature versus technology and stuff like that. So I think that in that way it is kind of apt.
But probably a little more adult.
Yeah.
For the most part.
I also think that, like, his style is a lot more relaxed in a way, or, like, breathy.
Sure.
Spielberg's style tends to be, like, pretty, you know...
Yeah.
Intense and like
his. I will say he has more of a Japanese quality to his films, I guess, because he is.
If you want to make broad generalizations,
I'll say though, like, I've noticed that Japanese filmmakers love to kind of like stop and focus on things, though. Do you, I feel like American filmmakers.
I think those are the Japanese filmmakers that tend to be popular in America.
You think so? Because I
mean, there's people like Fukasako who just throws crap at the screen for like 2 hours. I don't know.
I mean, yeah, you got Fukasako, but I mean, like, is he considered that great as in Japan, or is he just considered that great because? Because I thought the. But we were having this discussion earlier, I think, about Ozu and about how him and Mizoguchi are kind of considered the greats in Japan. And then Akira Kurosawa, who had a more Western style, was more popular in the States, but not as much in Japan. And so, comparatively, looking at the Ozu and Mizoguchi films that I've seen, I would say that Miyazaki's style is closer to Ozu and Mizoguchi than it is to Akira Kurosawa, for sure.
I definitely agree with that.
So of those two directors who, mm-hmm. I guess, are sort of considered the greats in Japan, I would say Miyazaki is closer to their style.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I mean, I think, like, again, like, Oshima is another director who's considered pretty great in Japan and is not like that.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Although his films were not as popular, but compared, you know, like they're more critical favorites than popular favorites, comparatively speaking. Like Ozu was way more popular, but this is all speculation at this point.
It is speculation. I don't have any hard facts to back.
I think this entire section should be scored to that Alphaville song.
I think Mizoguchi and
the
Ozu
Big in Japan song.
Yes.
I was gonna say Mizoguchi and Ozu could have probably made movies for another 50 years without any explosions, though. And there are lots of explosions in Mizoguchi movies.
And Miyazaki's films.
Miyazaki, I mean. Yeah, sorry.
But some of that may be based on budgetary constraints also, although I guess if you're Ozu or Mizoguchi, you can get as much money as you want, but it's true, he does have lots of explosions, but they're also animated explosions, so
right, it's pretty easy to make explosions for the cost of same as drawing almost anything else, probably.
I wonder who's listening anymore, honestly, to this podcast right now.
No one ever listens to them.
Talked about
our
visions of who's popular in Japan.
We are listening, four of us. It's us listening to ourselves.
And yes,
yeah,
us, our greatest fans.
We don't even have enough ratings on iTunes.
To really care.
A rating like
that's true. Oh wow, how many ratings do you need? Like two?
I don't know.
Probably just
as far as I know. As far as I know, I'm the only person that's rated the podcast.
Oh, I want to rate the podcast. How do I rate the podcast?
Go to iTunes.
You have to sign up for an iTunes account.
Yeah, go to iTunes.
Oh, I don't have an iTunes account.
The things that I should be saying at the end of the podcast, but refuse to.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, right. You should just recommend another podcast that people should rather listen to.
This time I was going to tell people that if they like the podcast, they should go to iTunes and click play and play it for their dog, because dogs like podcasts.
Great
that
idea.
Was my joke.
We're
for
great
episode.
For dogs. The podcast for dogs. Good boy. Good boy.
Yeah, I think all that Basil and I were saying was that there's no problem comparing it to another director, but that you probably shouldn't say there's like a unified Japanese style of filmmaking. That there's a lot of filmmakers with a lot of different voices.
That's true. That makes perfect sense.
But yes, I do think that he's more like Ozu, or that he likes Ozu, I would guess.
Yeah, I mean. And since he's sort of a contemporary
Steven
Spielberg
does. Apparently Spielberg watched Kurosawa's Ron a lot when they were making Saving Private Ryan, which makes sense.
Yeah.
Also, he probably saw Come and See, Russian movie.
Uh-huh.
Because that's, as far as I know, Come and See, the Russian movie, is the first movie to have that, like some an bomb explodes close to someone, and then the person like can't hear and the audio is silent thing. Only for that movie, it goes on for like half an hour of the movie where he very slowly gets his hearing back over a really long period of time, as opposed to right away.
Whoa.
So that's a lot more realistic
yeah.
as opposed to just an effect.
Yeah,
it's true.
It's a cool movie. I'm writing about it for the website. Oh yeah,
we got you got Basil hooked on Russian movies now.
It's true. Can't stop watching.
That's really cool.
Won't stop.
Also, former Soviet bloc countries.
Yes.
Yeah.
Especially considering that you started off with Night Watch, the movie. It's really good that we got you.
It took me 8 years to watch a Russian movie after that one. I was like, this country didn't produce anything good.
Sucks at making movies.
Basing American cinema on Olympus Has Fallen or something. I don't know. I haven't seen Night Watch, but...
It's pretty close.
Some shit action movie.
Probably Underworld would be the closest.
Underworld,
right?
Yeah. Blurg. Is that American, though, or is that... I guess that's American, yeah. Although all British actors in it. Probably a British director, too.
It's like Game of Thrones.
That's how you achieve period authenticity.
Anyone who is still listening to the podcast, Underworld is really bad.
I actually haven't seen Underworld. I've seen the second Underworld movie.
I love when that happens.
Where there's like a half where I fell asleep during like the last half hour of it, and I just have like vague, like in and out, like, oh, I think there was like a werewolf eating someone or something. I don't know. I have no idea. I was so over that movie.
The only thing that's good about the movie Underworld is I saw it in college and like some friends were walking towards me at the quad and they were like, hey, we're going to see Underworld but we're about to leave, do you want to come with us? And I said yes and then immediately ran as fast as I could with my backpack full of bags all the way across the quad like as a semi-joke. And then like I met them outside and they were like, we really surprised you could run that fast. So that's my story about Underworld.
Yeah.
Good one.
I'm really surprised you could run that fast. That's a great comeback to that joke.
Wow.
All right.
So
I think we've said all
wind
we
rises.
Need Thanks. To say about the wind rising.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. And
as always,
go onto iTunes and something, blah, blah.
Look up some cool podcasts.
Yeah.
Go listen
There's
to
one about
like,
history that's pretty good.
Yes, we do appreciate you. We do appreciate you a lot.
We do. Go listen to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. Go listen to the Greatest Movie Ever podcast.
That's right. Doug Loves Movies.
Yeah. Oh, I was gonna do that this time, but I forgot.
Yeah.
What were you gonna do? Oh, other podcasts.
Well, I was gonna do a game.
Oh, a game.
The podcast, but I forgot.
Oh,
so I ran out of time.
Oh.
We'll do it next time.
Look forward to it.
Teaser.
All right, listeners. Next time there will be a game.
Yeah.
Just all right.
For you.
Let the games begin.
Hey, guy who talks to a crab.
Hey guys, you want to do some lines?
Okay, are we finished?
All right.
Okay,
bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Bye.